Welcome, everyone, to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hiya, Pete.
They already know we're here.
Pete, what are we talking about today?
Tonight, we are taking a look at, actually, Matt, our second look at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. episode 204, Face My Enemy, which was screened first for us and a couple lucky others at New York Comic Con Friday, October 10th.
Well, Pete, before we talk about Comic Con, who's the sponsor of tonight's episode?
Oh, yes, I would be remiss, man. We got to pay those bills. Tonight is brought to you by the surgical practice of one Dr. Daniel Whitehall. He'll operate on you for a week, but don't worry, you'll only be awake for most of it.
That is a tough sponsor tonight. With that, Pete, should we briefly talk about New York Comic Con?
Yep.
And listeners to our pop culture podcast heard an extended version of what we just quickly want to cover now about New York Comic Con. The headline, of course, at least the headline for us, was we had the distinct honor to see Clark Gregg in person. There was a whole raffle to try and get an autograph, and I won it. And you didn't quite win the autograph in line, but what happened is I went up there and I, you know, said hello, and you know, he took a look at my podcast shirt. Clark Gregg blew us away by recognizing the logo and said, "Hey, it's you, the podcast." So got to chit chat with Clark for a couple minutes, and you know, I said, "I'm here with my buddy Pete, who's down there," and he said, "Well, let's sign something for him." So, Pete, you got your autograph nonetheless, and I also got to chat with Jeff Loeb for a moment, shake his hand, thank him for all the wonderful television he has made. And, Pete, equal to that, I mean, that's great for me and all. That's great for us. But you and I then proceeded to watch the rest of the time he was doing signatures for, you know, for a whole bunch of other people. And how would you describe that, Pete?
Clark Gregg is everything that you would hope for in somebody who's found success at this point in his career. He is totally down to earth. He knows he's won the lottery, and he spreads that joy in everything that he does. You know, he would come down off the dais there to take a picture with somebody in a wheelchair. A couple wounded warriors went up and took a picture with him. You know, the guy's a pro, and he's just a true gentleman. And they're too far and too few in between to not hold up like this. I mean, yes, we've been fortunate enough to have him on the podcast. You can go back and listen to how generous he was with his time. And that was supposed to be even less time. And you know, can't say enough about the guy. Just really can't.
Yeah, I mean, it was an equal joy to see him interacting with everybody else. So enthusiastic, so genuine, so happy to see people, so happy to delight the crowd. And he was delighted by them. And just really, really what a treat, an absolute treat. Pete, later in the day at New York Comic Con, we went to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. panel, which I read. Since we recorded our pop culture podcast, that was the first panel on Friday that closed up. That I mean, it wasn't quote unquote for sale, but you know, there's only a certain number of bracelets to get in, and it was right. The first one to close up of the day.
Of course, it was.
Indeed, we saw this episode screened, so it's now our second time seeing it. Jeff Loeb was there again. Clark was there, you know, to thunderous applause. Some lovely banter between the two of them that we cover more in the pop culture podcast. After the episode, just as they were about to leave, we saw a little something else, and we can't talk about it right now, but just a reminder, real Marvel podcast fans stay to the end of the episode.
They do indeed.
With that, Pete, should we get this episode 204 up and running?
Yep. All right, time to catch you up on what went down. Our teaser set in Miami, specifically Santa Maria de los Flores Church, which has suffered a devastating fire. However, there is hope. A painting with its origins in the 1500s of Spain has emerged unscathed. And on the back of it, Matt?
It carved into it, it's more of that alien Bajoran Vulcan writing.
The Cree-fiti, as we've taken to calling it. So yet another time that's cropped up, and you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We've seen it on the obelisk. We've seen it, you know, at the edge of Coulson's knife there, and yeah, it's all connected.
I love that they're just unabashed that this is a serial story, and I think this episode is particularly accessible for a first-time viewer if you're aware you're coming in kind of, you know, in the lengthy middle of this ongoing story. But they're kind of not making any apologies. This is not baddie of the week. This is just, you know, another brick in that ongoing mystery.
Act one starts with Lance Hunter romancing a young lady on the beach in Miami, which looks surprisingly like Santa Monica, handing a necklace or some item that he's taken from this woman to Sky on a scooter. Come to find that tickets to the Santa Maria de las Flores charity event with the miracle painting run a cool $25K, hence the five finger discount.
So it's basically like Comic-Con.
It's essentially, yeah, it's Comic-Con. You know, cut to Coulson and May, who now having been furnished with fake identities, and being dropped off by Mac there, who restored this 1962 Rolls Royce that they get out of. And Coulson coldly tells him he's not working on Lola.
Let's not forget, though, Mac says words to some effect of like, you know, not yet. So I'm wondering if they're setting up something for the future.
It's coming. Come on. a flying car, man. It's going to happen, and Mac's the man to do it. Cut to this tremendous villa, this home that this charity event is taking place. There's dancing, there's champagne. May is laughing. and I think we'd be remiss to point out that you can hear Ming-Na Wen laugh as herself, in an interview we recorded last Wednesday with the lovely Melinda May, actress, on FantasticGeek.com.
Yes, whether you listen to us on the website or either of the podcast feeds, it is certainly there. And it was slightly surreal, Pete, to have heard her laugh a few times in that interview. And then, of course, you know, Melinda May does not laugh like that. But then here we have Melinda May playing someone who would laugh. And it was just this kind of slight disconnect that, you know, we heard that laugh on Wednesday, and then there we are on Friday seeing the episode. And it's, you know, it certainly is all great fun. And part of the fun of this episode is that they let May be someone who's completely different, someone who's coy, someone who's flirty, someone who's comfortable in her own skin, someone who's seductive, someone who's like Ming-Na Wen.
This was clearly Ming-Na Wen's finest hour as Melinda May. Forget the fact that she got to play herself twice with the whole face-off, face my enemy thing going there. But Matt, we'll table that conversation for a little later.
Indeed.
They had a really effective segue in this scene with the surveillance through the technique of the dancing and discussion about Coulson and May's time at the academy and the dance elective. But Coulson has turned off his comms and he has more serious matters on his mind. He wants to talk about should he go the way of Garrett and what the plan is. And May is clearly reticent to talk about that. And before you know it, they spot Brigadier General Talbot at this benefit.
That entire scene was just so chock full of double, triple, quadruple dramatic duty. There's just kind of the fun of it, of seeing the two of them dance, which of course just feeds into the whole undercover nature of the mission. On top of it, as you said, there's that whole, you know, cha-cha-cha, turn, okay, somebody at 10 o'clock, cha-cha-cha, boom, guard with a gun. Gives them an opportunity to be physically close to, you know, they have to talk about something that makes it look like they are a happily married couple, albeit in a very modern relationship. And, you know, so they talk about their mutual past, the things they know about each other. And then, of course, the reveal that Talbot is there. Talbot, by the way, on second viewing, who just seems unconcerned at noticing them or doesn't seem to be making the connection for reasons that, of course, are obvious once you've seen the whole episode.
Yes.
But just amazing how that scene does so many things at once.
I did notice the first time we were watching it that fake Talbot had suspiciously no gray, which actual Talbot has. So I don't know if that was their way of, you know, tipping it a little bit or not. But just to go back, expertly written as a scene to move things forward and to use the dancing as a device, and then wonderfully blocked. Matt, who blocked all that out? Who can we thank for the execution on that scene tonight?
This episode was directed by Kevin Tancheroen, who you might know from having directed the remake of Fame. You also might have heard that name before. He is the brother of Marissa Tancheroen, the co-executive producer, co-showrunner of, wait for it, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and head of Marvel Television. Jeff Loeb said at the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. panel on Friday that they were so happy with the direction that he did and that they looked forward to having him back soon. So it seems like it was a success all around, whether you're talking about critics, we the audience, or even those higher-up suits.
Keep it coming, man, if they're going to be efforts like this. Act two, Coulson and Talbot, you know, they don't spend the time running away from one another. Coulson goes right up and confronts him, and it leads to a not as tense a conversation as you would think, believe it or not. And Coulson decides still he's going to call the audible. They're going to get the painting now. May, meanwhile, is working over one of the organizers of the benefit, and between her speaking Spanish and her flirty nature there, again, just could not get enough of Ming-Na Wen in this episode.
It is just so true. I mean, it's nice that this really is a May episode, particularly since this is a character that we're not... we kind of know everything that they want to reveal about her at this point, but this really is an opportunity for us to delve into her past, etc., and, you know, to great effect.
We head down into the basement. There are, of course, laser beams. Why is it always got to be laser beams? And May walks right out into them because she's Melinda May, and they already know they're here. Only to find out that fake Talbot has taken the painting. Then, of course, he places a call to Dr. Whitehall, and we got the red herring that he is Hydra, when in fact, later on, we reveal him to be Mr. Bakshi.
By the way, that is Bakshi.
Bakshi, no, I'm sorry.
It's a lot to keep track of, Pete.
It is. It's such an unusual name.
Well, and also, I mean, I understand there's so many people at the Hydra meetings. You know, it's difficult to keep track of everyone.
Listen, it's confusing, okay? You know, we all have our Red Skull masks on, and, you know, everybody just looks the same. Act three. Features Talbot confronting Coulson and May outside. Okay, and they come to this understanding of helping one another out, neither trusting the other. Meanwhile, on board the bus, Head Simmons, hence Himmons, is talking to Fitz about trying to further bond with Hunter and Mac and Trip and Sky as they're all getting along, and she feels, or at least her side of him feels, that he's got to put forth a greater effort in terms of doing that.
It really, it's a lovely little subplot. And not even, I'm belittling it, calling it a little subplot. It is by and large the B story. Yes, there's the action through line of fake May. So would that be May coming aboard?
It's Faye.
Faye, okay.
Faye.
Faye and Falbert. And if any of them talk to Himmons, then we're in trouble.
Yes.
But anyhow, the Fitz story is the through line, is the B story on the bus. It's just masked by, you know, some of the secret agent-y, you know, button pushing that those in the bus are doing. And it's masked by the action of Faye dropping that thing in. But it really is, at the end of the day, it is an emotionally driven Fitz story, and just so, so welcome.
When May splits off from Coulson and, you know, she means business when the high heels come off, she heads to the hotel, presumably to meet fake Talbot, and instead runs into Agent 33, who you really kind of had to be, you know, dense during the previously on to not think she was going to rear her head in this episode. She stuns May, but not before Talbot is revealed to be Bakshi. And then Agent 33 makes herself the old Captain America static veil, last seen on Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff.
It's another one of those things, much like the Fitz invented, you know, super cutty thing that Nick Fury uses.
Yes.
Where, look, you could show this episode to newbies, which actually I intend to do later in the week, and they would just get it. Oh, it's a sci-fi secret agent mask thing. I mean, in fact, they do a great job in this episode kind of taking you through the science. Even if you're like, what? Now she's holding cellophane and his face is different. It's a mask? Then they take you through the pseudoscience behind it. The fact that you have already seen this before without the explanation in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and it clearly is S.H.I.E.L.D. tech, S.H.I.E.L.D. / Hydra, you know, previous to the split, the great reveal of Hydra.
The S.H.I.E.L.D. schism.
Anyhow, it's one of those things that just works so well, where, you know, the show now tells us how it works. It's not the lofty movie. It's the show that shows us how it works. So I'm sitting there watching going, okay, so S.H.I.E.L.D. grabbed the lady from the World Security Council and was like, hey, don't move. We're going to take some blood. Like, it's all connected. And I don't mean to overuse that. It's just they're letting it be connected in such a wonderful way.
They are. Act four begins with Bakshi sending quote unquote May, Faye, okay, to go take care of the bus and the other threats to Hydra. Head Simmons, meanwhile, is talking to Fitz, and he's having a hard time tolerating the changes to his lab. He even is railing that Ward is more valuable than him. And, you know, I thought we really got a nice advancement in his story tonight.
My pal and yours, Mike Sorensen on Twitter, I think that's Warcry_75, if I did it off the top of my head, predicted that Ian Dukakis is working on either an Emmy nomination or an Emmy win. Sometimes shows like this are overlooked, unfortunately. So the fact that it's the Marvel comic book Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that comes from the movies, you know, that there might be an unfair bias there. But I certainly would agree with Mike in spirit in saying such a wonderful performance out of Ian tonight. And in that scene in particular, Pete, there's such such rationalization as to why he feels separated from the group. Yes, it's through this screen of his brain injury, where he, I think normally, you know, season one Fitz would just be arrogant and be, you know, why are you doing this? Da da da. But it explains why he has kept himself separate from all these people and kind of continues to look down on them because they're being so awful to him, you know, is his perception. So just a lovely, lovely scene.
Definitely. May, meanwhile, comes to in her slip, handcuffed to a high chair, 5 feet from kicking Bakshi's ass.
Indeed, indeed.
Coulson, meanwhile, is with fake May in the car, and one track mind, he's back to their plan for what's wrong with him. Only problem is fake May does not know what he's talking about, but he needs to know that she can do what needs to be done. And he reveals before he knows that this is not May, that he's going to promote her to director upon his demise.
It was such a well-written scene in that the audience is now in on the joke, the dark joke that it's not her. And it really was written in a way where it was believable that he was speaking in a context that she did not have, yet she was able to pick it up just by saying, you know, kind of those ultimately neutral responses, but responses that sounded very insightful, like, you know, I'm sure you know what's best. And, you know, well, when the time is right, we will make a decision. Those kind of platitudes. And all of a sudden you're like, wow, she's really working her way in there. Although that tap of the hand, you know, her hand on his that she gives him, there's this moment in the scene where he's kind of saying, ah, wait a minute, that's kind of strange, isn't it? Which, of course, is going to get picked up in, before too long, Pete.
This, to me, is the quintessential season two episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to this point. It's only the fourth episode, I understand that. But it hits upon the perfect mix of, you know, the lighthearted material of season one and the darkness that they can have in the new 9 o'clock time slot with everything that's gone on. And it really balanced everything well. And I think that's the ultimate compliment. Meanwhile, okay, the bus has begun to shut down with what Agent 33, the circular device that she has sabotaged our S.H.I.E.L.D. Agents with. They are now sealed in, and as Coulson comes to the conclusion that May is not May because May hates coffee.
The old coffee reveal there gets you every time.
It does, which prompts a May face-off between her silver dress clad self, her fake self, and her revealing slip wearing self, her best self.
Pete, we of course are nothing but gentlemen. Let me just say, Ming-Na Wen, wow, what a beauty. We'll just leave it at that. We don't want to pontificate too much or ponder too much. But concerning the May versus May fight scene, having now seen it twice, the effects, the way that they use special effects, go above and beyond what we all kind of know, where it's like, it's split screen. Yes, there are moments where, hey, you didn't quite see her face as she did that spinning kick against Ming-Na Wen, whose face you could see. Okay, that's probably the stunt double. then cut to, you know, a two shot, and you can see Ming-Na Wen's head on the silver body with her arm pushing into Ming-Na Wen's, you know, other Ming-Na Wen, Good Mei's throat, and both faces are attached to both bodies, and the one body is touching the other, and it's all, they're all literally connected one to the other. And I'm sitting there going, where's the fake cut line? Where's the, you know, oh, her hand is beneath the screen and another hand is coming up. It was just flawless. I mean, you go from stunt woman whose face you can't see to a digital effect, intercut. It was just absolutely wonderful. It frankly blew me away for what you could do in a TV budget. It really was remarkable.
It was marvelous. I think the speed for most of it, other than the superbly gratuitous coffee table head slam in slow motion.
Yep.
You know, masked so much of it, but that's the intent of the speed of what happens. But that was great. I mean, through 26 episodes of this show now, that's like a top five highlight.
Absolutely. That was just all portions of that fight scene, starting with Good Mei breaking out of the chair, just viciously smashing, to, you know, the presumed conclusion of the fight with the table, which it will be a long day from now when I forget the reaction that got with 3,000 of our friends at New York Comic Con, where it was just boom, head on the table. Wow. I mean, just a movie quality scene here, exacerbated, made more difficult by the fact that you need to intercut the one actress twice into them to sell it. It's just remarkable.
All this is interwoven with Fitz and Hunter in the bowels of the bus, you know, fixing it. And then I did find it a little unbelievable that after Mei, coffee table stomped her doppelganger with that move, that Agent 33 could come back from that and then had to be electrified. But you know what? I was fine with all of it.
I'll tell you something, and if I have a criticism to this episode, it is one that is so, so minor. Seeing Fitz and Hunter in the bowels of the bus, they offered up the reason that Hunter was there, because Fitz has to use his words and not his hands. Okay. I mean, we've seen Fitz using his hands before. Look, in such a well-written episode, as Ron Moore has said many times, or actually as he has said once, but I have referenced many times over the years, you can get away with the occasional hand of the writer if it's done in the right spirit and it's not too gratuitous and it's not too often. I don't know that Hunter needed to be there, except Hunter needed to facilitate the moment later on where Fitz is going to start to come out of his cocoon.
Yes.
I grant you, show that you did that. I mean, it was worth it. It's a little, I don't know that he needed to be there, but it was well, it was well worked, because the conclusion of that that pairing was well earned indeed. So hats off, one and all.
Yes. And, you know, Mei ends that conflict, just underscoring the development we saw out of her character in this episode, that if you were really me, you wouldn't talk so much before taking care of business there. The Hydra team sweeps in. I found it a little goofy that they had the octopus logo on the back of their vests there. But then again, they did have a giant one in their science lab, so it is still a comic book universe.
It's also the visual nature of the medium. We need to be clear that they're Hydra, so they put a patch on the back and then shoot them from the back. Again, it's like one of those things where you're like, well, what do you want? People who are confused if it's like the SWAT team or if it's like Mac and Trip in gear. Like, it's just a quick, it's a small sin for a big save.
They find an 86th Agent 33, and before we know it, we're back in the playground where Fitz and Mac are putting things away. Lance Hunter comes in and tells him to drop anything, everything, which of course Fitz takes literally. And then he buys him a beer and they bond over everything that's happened.
A scene that was as touching the second time to see as it was the first. Just a little lump in the old throat saying they're welcoming him back. These are cool guys who are around him. Despite the fact that they've spent so much time on screen ignoring him, they're working to help him find the way back too. Just a wonderful, very touching scene.
Meanwhile, Sky and Trip talk about the painting. And let's not forget, and we'll look at it in a little bit more depth in our Level 7 segment, that Sky is as connected to the drawings on the painting and elsewhere as Coulson is to this point.
You know what, Pete? I will admit, I had momentarily forgotten that. And I... Let's see, I guess she probably doesn't know the degree. Like, she doesn't know the connection of the blood and Tahiti, and that's in her, and that's in him, and that's made him crazy, and that made last year's baddie, whose name's on the tip of my tongue.
The clairvoyant?
Yes, that made the clairvoyant see all the connections in the stars and all that.
Yes.
She does not understand that entire connection, am I correct?
I don't believe she does. I think this is subtext at this point. But you never know. Again, it's the nature of the GH325 that she received and whether she knows she's connected to it or not. That's not completely revealed at this point.
It's the nature of the beast, or perhaps the nature of the She-Hulk?
Maybe. Coulson, meanwhile, confronts the real Talbot. Great line. I mean, a painting? Really? As if to say Talbot would never be into art, and that was immediately the dead giveaway, which is, you know, great job. Adrian Pasdar in these flashes, their injections, but he's been wonderful. You know, the joke a little later on is that some people are better in small doses, of course, when he cuts them off. But, you know, just really good in that moment there. Now, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong. Coulson told Talbot that the painting was destroyed in the fight.
Correct.
Was it? It was indeed. Okay. I
can't swear that it was destroyed in the fight, but that it has been destroyed. Yes.
Okay. So, the thing there that Talbot reveals is that he spent 5 months in an enemy work camp, and you people make me miss those days.
I'm not complaining about the tone there. It just struck me as slightly. Like, certainly is a dark place to go. Like, you could say, like, there are days that I'm up to my elbows in paperwork, and you guys make me miss that. Ha ha ha. This is like, yes, I was a prisoner and perhaps, you know, tortured and starved. It certainly speaks to Talbot's, I don't know, uber manly demeanor and, you know, how tough he is and whatnot. It was just, I'm not saying it was a miss note. It was just an unusual note to take.
Coulson then reveals to May that the painting was indeed 500 years old, but the writing was new. So the question is, who's doing it? And then we turn back to, for the final time in the episode, this very heavy discussion about the plan. And May reveals what her plan is, and it's not putting one between Coulson's eyes, but it's a passport, it's cash, it's a ticket to the outback, because Coulson likes kangaroos.
that could be the spinoff series, Coulson. Yes. And the kangaroo. He's out there like, hey, let's go to Ayers Rock,
BJ and the bear. I thought it was a quintessential Clark Gregg moment. He says, you know, that's the sweetest thing anybody's ever done for me, but you're going to forget it and you're going to kill me when the time comes. And that's the commitment that he needs to get out of May. And it's really the heart of this episode, this relationship between these two. What do you ship them, Matt? It's, isn't it?
I think the cool kids
it's Molson,
call it,
right?
Valinda.
Don't you call him Molson?
Molson.
Yeah. Hashtag Molson. So, you know,
that might be next week's sponsor if we could swing it.
You know, we cut to our tag scene at the end, and you know, I just got editorialized for just 1 second. And Matt, we talked about this coming back from New York Comic Con. When you see Ruth Negga's name in the opening credits and she hasn't appeared by the end of Act 5, guess who's in the secret tag scene?
That's just the nature of this wacky world of Hollywood. Certainly these people deserve on-screen credits. I wish that there was some a mechanism in place where you could say, hey, when we don't credit you for dramatic purposes, you get an extra $20,000 or whatever it is. It's just something that both sides could easily agree upon. And I mean, there's probably also some sort of intrinsic, you know, value to credits. You've worked hard. You want to see your name in the credits, that kind of thing. But I totally agree. Anytime a show, I mean, you know, it's obviously not just Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but you'll be like, whenever there's these great recurring characters and you happen to know their name, you go, oh, Jack's dad is in this one. Oh, Denise Crosby is going to be in Walking Dead again. It's just, you just see that name pop up and you go, oh no, now I've just set the clock to see when they're going to appear, you know, and as the minute that there's someone mysterious, you go, okay, here they come, as indeed you did, Pete.
So she gets in her car and of course behind her pops Dr. Daniel Whitehall. This is over the obelisk. And he produces a device, which may or may not be the same type that was used on Tony Stark by Obadiah Stane at one point. That kind of paralyzes him. But he cuts to the quick of it, that Raina's tricks don't work on him, that he's not easily confused, that he doesn't do his own dirty work himself. And it frees him up for so many other things. He needs that obelisk back in 48 hours, or he's going to be spending more than 48 hours operating on Raina, which he's done before, but he's so much better at now.
That was just such a chilling scene. Uncomfortable, and I'm not saying shame on you, show, for having made it so uncomfortable, but certainly just an uncomfortable take, clearly, given his lack of aging. You know, we're thinking World War II, we're thinking concentration camps, we're thinking the worst of the worst. And I mean, so chilling, and dramatically speaking, to kind of, you know, to dial away from real world connections, so dramatically effective to just really nail home. This is not some, you know, some guy who throws icicles at you. He's a villain because of what's between his ears. And that's the worst kind of villain, because he's really smart and he's really composed and he's really, really in control of this evil enterprise. And I mean, that scene just sells it and sells him as just this incredibly creepy, awful villain that the show has to deal with.
The dossier.
Normally, the dossier is a detailed look at our bad guys, but given that we've seen so many of these before, there's really not a lot to do. I mean, we can talk Talbot, which wasn't really Talbot, which was actually Bakshi. I want to look at Agent 33 here, though. Someone that we watched broken in, I want to say, the second episode of the season, right? With the
it is a bit of a blur having seen this episode twice and all the other adventures of the past week.
Yeah, let me look back for 1 second here. Maybe it was
last week. But I mean, certainly she's an interesting character in that. I mean, it speaks to how quickly this.
Yes, it was the third episode.
Okay, it was only last week. Wow. It just speaks to how committed this brainwashing can make you. Now, Pete, I have a question for you, and perhaps this is better left for level 7. Although I don't think it's an overarching mystery. Do you think Agent 33 is dead, having been kind of like shock burned in the face, in the eye? I mean, that seemed kind of, I know you can obviously, you know, have eye damage and live, but I thought that was kind of TV code for, oh, her beautiful face has been scarred and her eye pecked out by electricity. She is done for.
I took it to be that she's, her goose is cooked, Matt.
She is, as Dr. Whitehall would once say, the kaput.
You know, but we get her over a multi-episode arc here, and there had been some talk that Coulson was looking to bring her back into the fold after, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s resources were scattered to the wind, and that she was weaponized against them, and she uses that in the course of her fight with May. You know, I know all your moves. I used to be S.H.I.E.L.D. This enemy within and without dichotomy that we're still seeing within this show, and we're going to be seeing for some time. I hope, and I have faith they'll sustain it. But it really worked here, and you give the bad guys an agent on the level of the ones that we're dealing with, a henchman type, if you will, you know, a foil. Good guys, and it was effective.
It definitely was. And I mean, there's something kind of fundamentally disturbing about the notion of brainwashing, and that somebody can be turned from a goodie to a baddie so quickly, then kind of add the layers of, you know, it's Talbot, but it's not, it's May, but it's not. And it's kind of a very, you know, it's a very paranoid episode deep down, you know, obviously with kind of the easy to understand good guys and bad guys once the you know, the masks are revealed. But, you know, as I said, kind of like a really creepy underpinning. And Agent 33 certainly encapsulates that completely.
We've had an Agent 13 in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, who has now joined the CIA, at least the last that we've seen her. We have an Agent 33 here. Are there 99 agents? 99, I seem to remember, was, you know, on another spy show.
Well, I think, Pete, I mean, we can chart out the progress of female agents in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I think it is safe to assume that either in the spring portion of episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or perhaps this, you know, late spring, early summer in Daredevil, we've had 13, we have had 33, we're going to see Agent 53. It's all math. It's just science.
It's just science. Bakshi is here, but his presence is not as big. And we do get the sadism of him electrifying May, and the idea that he's out there and he put the static veil on to assume Talbot's identity. So he will get his hands dirty, even though he to this point kind of had that sharp, useless, you know, bad guy vibe to him.
I wonder how much of that is a function of the story. I mean, when that veil comes off, you need to reveal someone recognizable. It's semi-established that Whitehall is, you know, maybe not the tippity-top of Hydra, but the tippity-top of his cell, of his operation. You're saving him going out in the field for the capper of this episode. So perhaps that was just a case of, well, who else do we know from Hydra? Bakshi. Bakshi goes on a mission today.
Bakshi's back. All right.
Ah, boy. From the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. With that, Pete, should we keep this bus a-moving?
Indeed.
Welcome to Level 7.
time to analyze and theorize. Matt the Creefiti, written in Garrett's lab on the obelisk, this 500-year-old painting. Coulson conveniently left out, oh, and oh yeah, I went 18 days between drawing it on a big wall and May taking pictures of it.
It'll be interesting to see what they do with that. Was the entire notion of the church and the church fire and the old painting that has not old writing but new writing, was that kind of all of a red herring, or are we going to see purpose behind that when the mystery writer is revealed? I won't particularly complain if you're just like, oh man, they found Joe Schmo and he carves this stuff too, and there's kind of not an explanation. It was just kind of, you know, a big splashy, you know, well, we need something for there to be a fundraiser for so we can have, you know, Ming-Na Wen acting happy and dancing, you know, like perhaps it was done in reverse from there. But it would be really nice that once they get, you know, Creefiti 2, man.
Electric Boogaloo.
Electric Boogaloo. You know, if there's some sort of, you know, real connection, like he's a former priest or something of that effect, that'll tie back to that key setting.
Or he's Sky's father.
You know, I've thought of that, and I would be okay with that, but that just seems, you know what that seems like, Pete? That seems like the protocol droid that Luke Skywalker happens to buy as a boy also happens to have been built by his father when his father was a boy. That's a little bit too all connected.
I could see a scenario where it can work. But we'll have to see how that plays out. Let's talk about Agent Coulson, or Director Coulson. Sorry to bust his rank there. And Agent May. There's talk of a their first mission, a retrieval operation in Sausalito. They've clearly spent a lot of time, and they have a history. Matt, are they becoming more than boss and trusted right hand?
Nope. I am going to say right now, no chance at romance. Now, might they do a sneaky switcheroo like Coulson, while feverish, says, I've always loved you. Or May, while infected with the alien virus, you know, does some whatever. To me, they're mom and dad, but they're also the president and the vice president, if you will. They're mom and dad in a non-literal sense, but they're also these people's bosses. They are equals, if not by rank, then by life experience, shared experience together, and so forth. So I can't imagine the show going in that direction. Could you, Pete?
I can, and I really do think it's going that way. You know, to build as much as they did, and kudos to ABC's promotions department for getting Ming-Na Wen and Brett Dalton, Elizabeth Hensrich, and BJ Britt onto Dancing with the Stars on Monday night, in a nice little tie-in to the dancing going on in this episode. But I think there's no dancing around the fact that Coulson and May Molson are becoming a little something-something.
Well, I vote no, they're not on that. But Pete, I have another question for you.
Yes.
And it's something that I think requires a little willful suspension of disbelief, because I don't believe that the show would do this for business reasons, but within the narrative of the show, you know, is Coulson going to die / whatever? Like, for example, I could imagine some scenario where he's out of commission for 4 episodes as, you know, in a coma or something like that, to pay the price for this, you know, Creefiti in his head. It seems that they're hinting towards his demise of some sort. Will they kill Coulson again?
Absolutely not. He's been dead once. We can't do that twice. And I think it would kill a lot of other people to see that happen. You know, we're going to play this game where he reveals, and she doesn't know this, that this has happened. Actual May doesn't know that Coulson has made with the plan to promote her to director. So maybe it might be a temporary incapacitation type of thing. You know, the vice president takes over, but there's no way they're going to kill him. I could see him incapacitated, unable to do his job, to perform his duties, but they will not kill him.
Fair enough.
One more from me here. Hunter's Goddess X, who is also, there was an interspecies thing happening. He's a human and she was a demonic hell beast. I know there's some theories out there, Matt.
Are there? Tell me more. I mean, that when he first said, you know, interspecies, it was like, and then it sounded like he was being figurative, but tell me more, Pete.
Agent 33, the X?
Oh, that theory. I take that back. Yeah, that's a good theory. To me, again, it's a little, you know, Anakin Skywalker made C-3PO and new R2-D2. It's just a little closed universe as opposed to all connected. I would much rather, and I'm gonna share something about myself that I'm not too proud of. Under duress, for all the right reasons, you know, to impress the woman who became my life, my wife.
Your life.
I'm going to admit it now on the podcast with the millions and millions listening. I've seen the first couple seasons of Grey's Anatomy. And I can tell you, Pete, the way season one of Grey's Anatomy ends, it's with McSteamy and a lady, somebody, talking, and the references me, and it's like, hey, the guy, do you remember the guy that broke up our marriage? The guy that broke up our marriage? And in the background, you see somebody walk into frame, out of focus, and walks up. I guess it's not McSteamy, it's the other guy. And then into focus comes McSteamy, grand reveal, new character. This is the guy we've heard so much about that broke up your marriage and broke your heart and blah, 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 blah. I would much rather that the show do that and you go, Pete, did you hear that, you know, Victoria's Secret model so-and-so, or did you hear that, you know, some really great get is going to be on? Well, who are they going to play? Who are they going to play? And it's at the end of the episode where they go, you know, it's, I'm looking for Hunter. And it's like, who are you? I'm his ex-wife. I'd much rather that than like, oh, we've already met her. And now he's so concerned about her because she's been brainwashed. And he says, no, my love, no. No, don't go that route. Go big, you know, big guts and make her somebody new and interesting. Not, you know, oh, we've known her since the third episode.
I can absolutely live with that. I'm just throwing it out there, man.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Transmissions. Matt, let's open up that mailbag.
Pete, today we are focusing on one bit of mail. And it's a good one. I had asked on Twitter, I just out of the blue sent out a message. I said to Nick Blood, who of course plays Agent Hunter, I said, hey, Nick Disco Blood, because that's his name on Twitter. A bunch of we Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fans were wondering what you guys were drinking in the beer scene. Because indeed, Pete, there's some people on Twitter saying, you know, hey, what was that? Looked like a craft beer. It looked like this, looked like that. So I said, any clues for us chaps? And he responded within a couple of minutes to our great honor. He said, try a screen grab. You got to try and work it out. So I want to share that challenge with everyone. I'm sure in the next couple of days, Pete and I will, you know, be able to sit down, do a rewatch, do a screen grab. If any
grab
of
a
you,
sixer.
Indeed. If any of you get there first, feel free, take that screen cap, you know, post it on Twitter. You know, let us know. We'll obviously retweet. We'd be happy to take your picture, put it on the, you know, take your picture of the screen cap, put it on fantasticgeek.com, credit you. And I mean, look, is this a major mystery? No, but I think it's a fun little mystery. The fact that he's not willing to tell us what the prop the fake prop craft beer was. That's kind of cool. Let's tug on that thread and see where it goes as a fan community. You know, is this the new Apollo bar? Let's find out together, courtesy of Nick Blood.
Well, given that, you know, Shield's logo has been on everything in the show from the top of the bus to water bottles, you know, I wouldn't put it past them, you know, the Shield lager here, you know, the Shield shandy, what have you.
Shield, the beer.
You put the picture's name on everything. You know, so really cool there and nice of Nick Blood to hit us back with that. You know what else is nice, Matt? When people take time out of their busy schedules to review this podcast on the iTunes. And I believe we have a little something-something for the next new review on iTunes.
Indeed we do. We were able to score a couple of mini posters for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter. They're about, what, 12 by 18? I feel like we've had this discussion before, by the way. But the next new review on iTunes, as with any review, please do shoot us an email with the iTunes name that you use to review things, because everybody is going in a pot for a raffle prize later on. Probably, Pete, am I right that the raffle drawing would be between now and December, you know, like once this fall block of episodes has concluded?
The mid-season finale,
as they call it. But most immediately, we're looking to give away one of those posters, which actually Pete rather presciently pulled right out of the main stage room at New York Comic Con when a couple other people left theirs.
Five-finger discount, yo.
That's right. Pete, you're such a sky. So we'd love to share our bounty from New York Comic Con and send
and our
that
booty.
To you. Well, I wasn't going to say that, Pete. But anyhow, the bounty, the booty, whatever it might be. So get on there, start reviewing the iTunes. Now, Pete, some people don't just want to review. They want to interact with you. And how can people do that on the Twitter?
You can find me at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 4,326 followers. Can't be wrong.
I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. However, you can get in touch with the podcast. We are Fantastic Geek, that is fantastic with the PH, and you can get in touch at the .com, the Twitter, and the Gmail. With that, Pete, I will say auf Wiedersehen to all our listeners and give you the mostly final word.
The caterers ran out of coconut shrimp. There's no reason to stay.
Hi-de-ho, ladies and gents, and welcome to the Agent Carter radio program by Fantastic Geek. In January 2015, we'll be bringing you the lowdown about the television series dedicated to that dandy dame, Peggy Carter. My name is Matt, and joining me each week is one real ace, Pete. What's buzzing, cousin?
Greetings, Matt. How are you tonight?
I am so excited to be here at the microphone talking to you about Agent Carter.
Yes, yes, very exciting times, and we look forward to the latest addition to the Marvel Cinematic Universe this January.
We are dropping this episode, of course, in October. I think our hopes are to do maybe another one with whatever news we have in November and December before hitting the ground running with the series. Each week, the night that the episode airs, we'll be dropping a podcast episode offering news and analysis, etc.
Yes, and for those of you that listen to our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, the format will be a modified format to that. Era appropriate, of course.
Indeed. And with that, Pete, should we get to our first segment?
Indeed.
News of the hour!
In this segment, we run down the top stories of the episode and give you the latest and greatest in the need to know. Pete, tonight we talk the secret footage that we viewed at New York Comic Con.
Yes, very exciting. Over the weekend, we were the first outsiders from Marvel to see footage from the upcoming Agent Carter show, which again will bow in January. Marvel head of television Jeff Loeb was on hand along with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. star Clark Gregg. And when Jeff Loeb revealed he was wearing a Hydra t-shirt beneath his button-down t-shirt, Clark Gregg came out to admonish him for that, and then told him he needed to make it up to both him and to the fans on hand. He did that by first showing, Matt?
Well, first he showed us a full-length episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which was just absolutely fantastic to see.
Yes, and not quite the makeup you thought it was going to be, given that it was on the agenda. It was on the schedule. But what was next was not. At the end of the episode, you know, Loeb made like he was going to shut things down, and Clark Gregg came out again, and he said he still had not made it up to us, and he demanded we see something, you know, nobody's seen, and he produced a DVD from his leather jacket that was purported to contain a scene from Agent Carter. That was shot on Monday. We viewed this on Friday. Given that it was completely edited with music, I had a little bit of a hard time buying that. But given that Dominic Cooper, who plays Howard Stark, Tony Stark's father, reprising his role from Captain America, the First Avenger, that signing took place September 30th. We at least know it was shot sometime after then.
And certainly it was quite a surprise. It was great to see kind of the flavor of the show. And Pete, what exactly happened in that scene and a half that we saw?
Yeah, I was taken aback immediately by the aesthetic, and it's not easy to shoot you know, for a specific period. Everything took place at night. We had a vintage car roll up on a pier. There was an overhead shot where three people were seen getting out of the car, one female.
By the way, Pete, I believe in the 1940s, they called those new cars.
They did. One of the new motor carriages. Go down and see the boys from Ford. But they went down to a dock where Howard Stark was explaining to Peggy Carter, played again by Haley Atwell, of Captain America, of both Captain America movies to this point. And Stark was explaining that he was on his way to Europe, that he had to track down a paper containing a formula for a substance he's worked on that's powerful enough in small doses to level entire city blocks, and that only a few people were capable of even trying to peddle this explosive material that he had manufactured. Peggy then returned to the car where Stark's butler, Edwin Jarvis, who's being played by James Darcy, another Brit. So we had a scene here with three British-born actors, two of which were using their British accents, was the only thing I had a little bit of a hard time with was James Darcy's accent as Edwin Jarvis. Jarvis, of course, will later be the namesake for Tony Stark's AI in the Iron Man suit. So obviously this butler will make some kind of Alfred-esque impression, if you will.
Ooh, crossing the companies there.
The streams too. Yeah, watch out. So Jarvis explained, apparently there had already been a conflict between Carter and Jarvis. He had apparently sustained a possible concussion from her. We don't know how. And he said he would help, but that he and his wife have to be in bed by 9 o'clock, although he has already once caught the help pocketing the good spoons after bedtime once. We then quickly flashed to a very rapidly cut action sequence of Carter.
Well, Pete, if I may interrupt.
Yeah.
His statement of him and his wife in bed by 9 o'clock. I think he had some sort of question like, why, what do you do at 9 o'clock? Or even if he didn't say that, she then fed off this whole 9 o'clock bedtime thing by saying words to the effect of 9 o'clock is when I just start getting to work. Then cut to
her beating the hell out of a guy in a kitchen, a mustachioed bad guy before he went out a window, and then the Agent Carter title card.
Certainly an exciting start, and well summarized there by you, Pete.
Thank you.
The lineup.
What lunkheads deserve some time in the joint? This list of baddies will tell us just that, Pete.
Well, apparently this guy who just got ejected out a window, he might deserve some time in the clink there. We don't have a name. We have a mustache, and that's about it. And then there's the baddies, Matt, I'm sure, that are probably associated with the remnants of the public face of Hydra at that time in history, who have taken Tony Stark's Howard Stark's, and are synthesizing explosives from them.
Probably not the first time between you and I will mistake Tony Stark for Howard Stark, not in, you know, actuality, but just kind of tripping over the two words, because we've spent so much time with Tony, now we get to flash back to dear old dad.
Yes. I would imagine that Hydra is going to be the biggest bad in this series. And again, I mean, we're talking 8 episodes to this point. It remains to be seen if this is even a TV show that they're going to extend past this. For all we know, this is their foray into an extraordinarily limited series, and there you have it.
Fair enough. With that, we will keep things moving.
Classified top secret.
Holy mackerel, time to take a gander at what the G-Men don't want you to know. Pete, my first question to you: this explosive material that Howard Stark is going to investigate, do you think that in this first pilot episode we're going to jump into Hydra stuff, or will we take a step into kind of a larger world of nefarious ne'er-do-wells?
I think it has to be connected to the Hydra threat, at least initially. Whether something, you know, crops out of that, so much of what Marvel is doing apart from Guardians of the Galaxy right now is connected to the downfall of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the revelation that Hydra had infested it for 70 years. So I think in weaving the story into that, they have to weave out of that. And, Avengers Age of Ultron will really be the full extrication from that storyline as we move from the Hydra threat, which is still in that film, to things even scarier than the enemy within.
It must have been an interesting discussion amongst the Marvel TV higher-ups to broach that very topic, simply because the Hydra threat is so current in that it is a current threat on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is both preceding and following Agent Carter in the overall TV season. Flip side, I don't know, do we want to spend all of the 2014-2015 Marvel TV broadcast season fighting Hydra. I think there are pros. I think there are cons. On further flip side is Agent Carter as a series needs to figure this out pretty quickly. There are only 8 episodes. So it's not like you can say, well, we'll do 2 with Hydra. Then we'll do a couple kind of standalones. Then we'll do with this. I mean, you're going to be two episodes into the first season of Agent Carter, and you will be at the 1/4 mark of the season. So things need to move in a rather, I won't say quick manner, but a rather compact manner. And I guess time will tell in January.
This explosive, Matt, is this going to be something we've heard of before that Howard's son will be utilizing? Will this be something that will be played into Avengers or even Ant-Man, which is now rumored to have its own flashback type of sequence?
I think it's possible, but they need to be careful that it's not kind of too inside baseball. Now, the notion of it having a reference to Ant-Man and the older, you know, the 60s, 70s Stark, that I think is a better bet. Just because, A, that movie's already written, so that's a fixed point that the show can latch on to. Second, it's a little bit less, shall I say, direct, in that if there's tons of time where Agent Carter is talking to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. storyline, it's going to feel a little bit too cute, because we know that we as an audience are meant to be watching both. Whereas, yes, of course, we're also, you know, we're meant to be going to the movies as well, but there's just a little bit of a time buffer, of a style buffer, and I think it would be too cute if it's like too many times where it's like, and here's Peggy Carter's second 084, which Coulson just found before right. they wrapped up their fall episodes. Like, that would just be, I don't know, not challenging to us as viewers. That would just be right. carrying things from week to week and calling it a different series.
Africa is going to be a location in Avengers Age of Ultron, and I'm just wondering if maybe, although that seems to deal with maybe something found in the mines of Africa, and Europe's a long way from Africa, but you never know, you could just cross the borders there. Wondering if that might become an issue. And Matt, do we know of any Marvel superheroes who hail from the darkest continent?
Well, I do know that the project that Hydra had in Captain America 2 to wipe out all those questionably powerful people did also identify some people in Africa. So certainly the hopes of perhaps future Marvel adventures taking place with characters from there, I guess time will tell.
Black Panther, maybe?
Could be Black Panther. You never know. Absolutely. Then maybe they found Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. Yeah. You never know.
One other note from me here, classified top secret. So Jarvis, we now know, is based on a person. What will happen to Jarvis? Will he, you know, live a nice long life here, or caught up in Peggy Carter's adventures, will he die prematurely, thus leaving such an impact on a young Tony Stark?
I think certainly it'll be interesting to see if they do anything with that in the course of 8 episodes, perhaps, you know, explore it in a further second season. Pete, I think now is a good time to stress to new listeners that while we certainly are fans of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and of Marvel Comics in general, we're not kind of deep down nitty gritty Marvel Comics guys. So if I'm incorrect in what I'm about to say, that's the explanation. But I believe that in the comics, Edwin Jarvis is Tony Stark's, I do stress that, actual, you know, butler, and they didn't want to carry it over to the movies because it felt right. like an Alfred ripoff, which it was. So the fact that they've kind of, I won't say retconned, but they've kind of reconned him, if you will.
Right.
It's a good use.
I think so, and I'm interested to see what Darcy's going to come with here.
And tell me, future boy.
Here we take a wacky look at references to Marvel's past and ours in the future. Pete, we didn't get a ton of that in this scene and a half. Of course, there is the Jarvis stuff that you've referenced, However, I thought something else that was kind of touched on was just this notion of, wow, Peggy Carter's a different kind of lady. She goes out at night to, you know, get into fisticuffs. again, slightly playing off of, you know, gender stereotypes and whatnot of the era, and something that I imagine the show is going to play with, or, you know, whether it's like cigarettes, they make you stronger. Ha ha. Just, I imagine there's going to be those sorts of jokes in addition to the, you know, one day maybe a man will fly in a metal suit, you know, lines like that.
Exactly. And, you know, there aren't, it's amazing. It's 2014 and there still aren't yet enough strong female characters for my taste on TV, and it makes the few that we get that much better. And the idea that, you know, this story coming up, this abbreviated series to this point, is really so hinged around the wonderful Hayley Atwell, and the idea that, you know, we'll see her out there kicking butt, and, you know, the sexual revolution will be decades away. It's exciting. It's exciting to see that in a superhero universe, not even so much at the time when this will be taking place. I mean, Captain America is it, and he's now lost in the ice. So, you know, it'll be a different kind of show between the period that it's shot in and, you know, the subject matter that they'll deal with. And, you know, I got a real noir feeling from the footage, which I'm fine with. And I'm really looking forward to them hearkening back to that age, because I think they did that really well, you know, in the original Captain America film. And from what we're hearing with flashbacks coming in the next two Marvel movies.
Absolutely. Certainly an interesting road ahead. With that, Pete, we'll take out a nickel.
Long distance.
Pete, a particular focus for our long distance is the iTunes. Tell us more.
Well, the iTunes is a newer device that will allow you to wirelessly, fancy that, download information and content from your computer machine. And if you go to iTunes and search Fantastic Geek and the Agent Carter series or our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Podcast, whichever it be, we love your reviews. And we're going to be offering a special premium, Matt, to the first two reviews we receive for Agent Carter.
Indeed. We were able to get some small posters from New York Comic Con that have Agent Carter on the one side and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on the other. Pete, would you say they're about 12 by 18, something like that?
Yeah, I think a little bit bigger than an 11 by 17, but suitable for framing on either side. Really, really nice. And our gift to you with the first two Agent Carter podcasts by Fantastic Geek reviews on iTunes.
And we just ask that after you've sent the review in, you know, it takes a day or two for iTunes to process it, do just send us a quick email with the name of your iTunes, you know, the way your iTunes username appears in reviews, just so that way we can correctly identify who it is and be in touch to mail that out to you. With that, Pete, you are practically a person of glitterati fame. How can people be in touch with you?
On Twitter, you can find me at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 4,317 followers. Can't be wrong.
Wowee. While I am personally on the Twitter as Looking Back Lost, you can be in touch with the radio program by being in touch with Fantastic Geek. That's fantastic with a P-H in plenty of ways. Send an electronic letter to us on the Gmail, post a note on the .com, or tweet us your telegraphs on the Twitter. Don't forget, Fantastic Geek is the way to go. With that, I'll say goodbye, good night, good luck, one and all. Pete, what wacky words will you close with tonight?
It's 9 o'clock, Matt. You know what that means. Lights out.